Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today is Thursday, November 17, and we have Eric Peters and Ira Harris. Eric is the founder, CEO, and CIO of $3 billion firm One River Asset Management and its subsidiary One River Digital Asset Management. Prior to founding One River in 2013, Eric served as chairman of Grant Capital Partners, a $1.25 billion discretionary global macro hedge fund, and he's held various positions that include portfolio manager for Peloton Partners, proprietary trader for both Lehman Brothers and Credit Suisse, and founder and chief executive officer of a T.H. Lee Putnam-funded technology firm. Ira's independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint most recently. And he maintains a blog at iragharris.com. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Richard. Great to see you.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks.
Great. I thought we'd begin, Eric, with your view on the macro perspective on the economy and the financial markets.
Wow. We could spend a lot of time just on that, I suppose. But yeah, again, Richard, great to see you. And Ira, wonderful to see you again. I really enjoy the work that you do and kind of everything that you published.
Thank you.
I know we're fellow pit traders from back in the day. So Richard didn't mention that I started my career in the pit, which, as I recall, is kind of how you got your start. Anyway, there's just so much to talk about right now. This has got to be this is the most interesting macro period of my career. I mean, there've been some intense bursts of activity at various points in time, but that have involved maybe the collision of monetary policy and over leverage and things like that. But we have so many different dimensions going on right now. I think we have probably the most important things to focus on are, I think, this transition from a world where policy has been dominated by our central bankers, monetary policy, to one where there's greater coordination between monetary and fiscal policy and potential for a collision between those two policies. So fiscal policy hasn't really been a dominant feature of markets for really the entirety of my career. And Ira may have just a couple years on me. So, you may have been more accustomed to kind of the combination of a more aggressive fiscal, and monetary, but really, I've been doing this for 33 years now, and I've never seen a period of fiscal policy and monetary and fiscal coordination like we have right now. So that's one of the most important things to consider when you construct your mental model and try to understand what's happening in the world. I think the other important consideration is that we have exited a world of increased globalization. We've entered a world of deglobalization. And really what I mean by that is just less integration internationally from an economic and even political perspective. And that's, I think it's not possible to really understand what's happening in the world without, adding that to your mental model, kind of considering what are the implications of that. Super, super important. And there's some other things I'm going to say around the edges. They're very important drivers of markets, but they're related to those two trends, or they're drivers of those two trends: a trend toward deglobalization, and then this trend toward greater monetary and fiscal coordination. And some of those trends that are related are have to do with demographics. I think demographics have created an environment, combined with globalization, that have pushed the need for fiscal policy. For instance, we got ourselves pre-pandemic into a position where where we had very low inflation, low interest rates, high levels of debt, et cetera, driven by decades of aggressive monetary policy. And we got ourselves in a position where we had very high levels of income inequality that were supported by this move toward globalization, toward increased globalization. And we had to kind of get ourselves out of that. And so that's where fiscal policy has come into play. So there, you know, the things like, you know, demographics that have played into where we are right now, there are things like income and wealth inequality have played into it. But the big, you know, kind of the big pillars are this policy mix shift combined with deglobalization. Anyway, that just to kick things off, it's helpful to kind of, at least as I view the world, it's helpful to kind of form the foundation of like, well, how am I going to look, like, through what lens am I going to look at things? And it's through that lens that I look at a lot of what's happening in the world right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Oh, Eric and I see the world, and not that we see the outcomes the same, but we proceed along the same thing. So I draw a picture, which was far different than the discussion. When was that, Monday, Richard? I've had bad COVID, so I'm just getting my real feet under me. But the conversation we had the other day, well, that's not the way that I operate, because I draw out this picture. And I think that's how Eric and I came to know each other, through the good auspices of a focal point, which was Gary Kaminsky. And I think Kaminsky was very much of that school and thought we'd be very compatible. So that doesn't surprise me. So we draw out this view. And as Eric talks about deglobalization is not that it has to be absolute. You know, everybody, we get really binary quickly. Oh, I'm a globalist, I'm a deglobalist. No, the world rushed and capital was rewarded. I thought one of the better things that came out of the work of Thomas Piketty back in 2011, 2012, but he had written several, I'd read a lot of essays by him, was that the rush for, you know, money basically arbitraging the globe, and money won. Money from the fall of the, well, I'd say 1989 for sure, but the change of China from Mao to Deng, and as I like to say, Deng had a great line, which is practice is the sole criterion for judging truth. Once China goes down that road, they now pursue not Mao's theories, what were known as the two whatevers, whatever Mao thought and whatever, but to an actual more scientific-based capitalist type of development. And we're only going to follow what works, not what theoretically works. I think the Fed could do a lot to actually understand that themselves. But we've pursued this and globalization and the global economy changed. You brought in all these workers who had never partaken of the capitalist world, they were more abused by the communist socialist system than the capitalist world. Now we can argue, had there been no that world, the capitalists would have been worse, but I doubt that, because even Henry Ford, who was a staunch capitalist, believed that you had to remunerate people enough, otherwise the system doesn't work, because they can't even afford to buy what you're producing. So what's the sense of it? So you've always had quote unquote enlightened capitalists. So as this starts to change, and the free, what is changing is the free flow of money around the world. It's changing. Is it the end of it? No, but it's not going to run unfettered in search of ever, you know, as Piketty would say, you know, rates are greater than growth. That's going to change. And worker remuneration is going to change. And so therefore we have to look at this and always adjust. I can't, you know, I've never believed in the, you know, my, when I had my firm and I was, the name of the firm, which I gave to a group of guys who are really great traders, and called Praxis, because it's always the theoretical and the practical. That's why I love Deng Xiaoping's quote so much. because you can theorize whatever you want, but if it doesn't bear out in practice, you know, then you're just an ivory tower intellectual and having a good time and getting paid anyway. I don't get paid unless the things I think about bear out in actuality. So I understand everything that where Eric's going.
Interesting. And Eric, in terms of the implications of these trends, deglobalization, the interplay between fiscal and monetary policies and forces, what do you see as resulting in terms of the market risk, credit risk, geopolitical risk, you know, to the economy and the financial markets?
Yeah, there are a lot. There are a lot in that the environment that I'm expecting we continue to remain in, as it's no longer theoretical. Going back a few years, our strong opinion was that an expectation is that we would enter this world following whenever the next recession hit, that we would enter a world where we get much more aggressive fiscal policy. We'd already started the path toward deglobalization. And so we thought we'd end up in a world that looked like this. But at that point, the trends toward deglobalization had already begun, really. But this fiscal monetary coordination had not. So that was theoretical. And these things play, that there's interplay between them. Because when you think about fiscal policy, it's very unique relative to monetary policy. And so it's probably worth spending a moment at least talking about that. So monetary policy is pretty monolithic, or had become pretty monolithic, in the sense that over the last few decades, while it's true that every country could have its own monetary policy, certainly had a right to have its own monetary policy, but in a world where the dollar is without question the global reserve currency, and in a world where there's increased globalization or increasing globalization, and that there's no law around that, but in an environment where politicians and therefore corporate leaders felt that, you know, there would be deeper kind of integration between economies, or next year there'd be deeper integration between economies than there was at this moment, then you'd be comfortable making the big capital investments to kind of take advantage of maybe lower cost of labor in this place or lower price commodities in this place. And, you know, and so in that world, you'd have in that world, you kind of had this set of expectations across both the kind of the political side of the economy and also the corporate side of the economy, that you could make large investments, that these investments would pay off over time. And as a consequence, when you thought about what central bankers were going to do, well, if central bankers ran a monetary policy that was significantly different from Fed policy, you would either have a strongly appreciating currency or depreciating currency. But more or less, no one wanted to have a strongly appreciating currency, because it would have disadvantaged your economy from participating in that world. And so the consequence of that is that over the last few decades, we have had a global central bank policies converge onto the Fed policy, because the Fed remained more or less, you know, pretty accommodative. So it's not to say they never hiked rates, it's just they never hiked rates really that high. And as soon as something materially went wrong, it could have been in the US or it could have been overseas, and that would have blown back to the US, or it could have just been a financial crisis that really wasn't an economic crisis, they would cut rates pretty significantly. And then over time, they had to do things like QE and, you know, various rounds of QE and a more aggressive QE and forward guidance. And so they kind of had to continue to increase the strength of their policy response. And because we're on this dollar system, that just meant that more or less every other central bank had to adopt some version of that. And so you ended up with global central bank policy converging on US policy. And that was really different, right? In a world of deglobalization, It's not to say that none of those features are present. It's just that now you have this in a period of deglobalization, when politicians are now starting to spend money, you have a much, much different dynamic, right? You have politicians who are we call them just a very heterogeneous group. So you have this group of central bankers who are all more or less doing the same thing. And then all of a sudden you have these brand new actors, right? And these actors are politicians, and politicians are making big fiscal decisions because central bankers can't make those decisions. That's not their job. And so you have a whole wide range of outcomes, because even in the US, like a fiscal policy under, say, Trump would be very different from fiscal policy under Biden. We could argue about how different those things would be, but certainly fiscal policy in Italy is different from Germany, is different from China, is different from Japan, is different from, you know, the UK. And so now we kind of have this increasing kind of mix of politics and central bank activity. And in that world, there are a whole new group of risks kind of bubble up. And some of those risks are economic, and some of them are geopolitical and have to do with military. So in this world, so I'll touch on that in just a second, but like in this world where we're transitioning from we call it homogeneous, you know, central bank policy dominance, which is a lot of words that sound too fancy, but just basically central bankers are in charge, to a world where it's more balanced, which is just heterogeneous policy that's driven by politicians, you can have a much wider range of outcomes. And one of the things that we've expected and we've seen borne out and we think will continue is that as you've reactivated politicians through this policy dynamic I just described, as you've reactivated them, you're going to, you know, like power is intoxicating in many ways. And as politicians become more assertive, I think new risks open up. So some of those risks could be, for instance, I don't know, like what do politicians decide we're going to do in addressing environmental concerns? They, you know, in the old days, they probably wouldn't have done much, honestly, because they just weren't, like if you thought about the last 30 years, politicians didn't really do, I can't point to any big programs that they put in place. And I know that someone would take issue with that, but more or less, I mean, relative to the last 100 years, we have not been through a multi-decade period where politicians have had big, you know, big policies that have pushed the economy in a particular way, or you know, contracted this sector and subsidized that sector. We're going to start seeing that now. But what we'll also see in that environment is, I think, greater conflict, because once the politicians are focused on a world where they're not expecting, you know, the next year or decade to necessarily be more tightly integrated, you know, you start having to think about your own nation and your own, you know, food supply and chip supply and manufacturing base and these things. And you become more risk averse, as opposed to just kind of letting the free market figure out how to divide global resources, how to go and source the cheapest labor, whatever it may be. And so we're starting to see those behaviors. So I think that's a long way of saying the range of risks, both economic and potentially military, open up. And so I think when we look at what's happened in the Ukraine, for instance, we see that as a manifestation of the new types of risks that are going to become more material in this world. When we see what, you know, the kind of the increased stresses in Taiwan, it's another manifestation of that. There are also smaller, you know, more internal political manifestations of that as well, which we see within countries. But we think that we will continue to see greater conflict. Nothing that moves in a straight line, but greater kind of conflict between nations in this world.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's great points here. And your thoughts, Ira?
No, I mean, Eric lays it out. And then, of course, what our viewers are going to look at, so where's our investable opportunities, if that is right? Because I happen to think that there's a lot of right to that, because again, as capital moves, as the free flow of capital slows, what is going to be our alternatives? And what do you really have to look at? And I think the Eric's beginning point takes me back to May of 2020, when we got an intro, it was, I can tell you, it was over the Memorial Day weekend, and Wolfgang Schäuble, who is probably one of the most fiscally conservative people that you would ever want to meet. I mean, he was, I think, highly instrumental in the German Schwarzenau under Merkel, probably the best thing that Merkel did, which was going to zero, black zero, as they call it, Schwarzenau. So then he comes out with, as COVID was beginning to spread, he comes out over that weekend and makes a comment that was so out of the ordinary, because he said, well, we need not to give loans to Italy. Loans is like giving them stones, as he said. We need to give them grants. That's giving them bread. And it made me sit up, and it actually made me bullish for a while of the euro, because I said, wow, this is a huge, and as a, this was going into the fiscal realm of Europe. Because, you know, Europe will always suffer because they have a very disjointed problem, which is they don't have a fiscal harmonization for the EU. But yet the ECB has a monetary policy, but monetary policy that is system-wide, but tax policy that isn't runs right into a wall. You're going to be very limited, but excuse me. So that really caught me off guard. I haven't heard much from Schäuble throughout the change in government and everything, but it was a very interesting comment because it gets right to what Eric's talking about. We are now, politicians are trying to regain their hold because they were also supplanted by the power of globalization too. Because if I could circumvent anything that you want to do by moving plant A here and plant B here, and they lost control of it too. And Bill Clinton promoted it. You know, it really begins with the Democratic Central Committee under Bill Clinton and Bill Clinton's famous trip to Beijing in 1998, which helped cement it. Now it's starting to recoil as history always does. You know, everything gets, you know, it's a great idea, great idea, great idea, until you know, those who've been displaced, and not just workers, but those whose power have been supplanted. You know, you, excuse me, and I'm an, my battle cry has been for more, well, I've been writing a blog, how many, 13 years? And I've always, around Davos time, said pepper spray Davos, because I've never trusted a group where you have to spend $650,000 to buy a ticket. Because my first instinct is, what does $650,000 buy me? I'll spend it. You know, it's like if you're borrowing money, what am I getting for? So you were getting, evidently getting something, because it was, as in Seinfeld, as it would say, the place to be. It was the place to be. And when, it, and for $650, it's not a $650,000, it's not a place to be unless it's the place to be. And what am I hearing that nobody else is, what am I paying for? So we are seeing this recoil, but from our perspective, how are we gonna then redirect ourselves and our analysis to be able to play into this? And in a world that's crying for greater globalization, in far as meeting the global challenges, climate change, pandemics, there are things that are global, but then we come more insular and look more in the traditional Westphalian nature of the nation state. Now we're going to have all kinds of major conflicts, and they're out there. And I'm not just talking physical conflicts. Everybody's trying to position themselves as to, well, how am I going to deal with this? And, you know, who are my friends? And you can't meet climate change without globalization. So if you want to deny climate change is important, well, then you can fall back into a nationalist answers. But if climate change is important and there's reality to it, and we can argue the science in many different ways. It's like arguing the science of COVID. There's no one, you know, it's not really science yet. The social policy, the policy is not science, because you don't have, science to me is an irrefutable, provable fact over and over again. You know, it's why economists, you know, I laugh. The economist group out of MIT and other places who want to turn economics into a mathematical certainty. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. So there are no easy answers. And it's why Eric and I can make a living. Because if the answers were so easy, we would just, you know, you just push a button, plug them in, but they're not that easy. So now we're tasked with figuring out what's going to be the answer to this and how do we make money through that.
Your thoughts, Eric, on the investment implications?
Yeah, I think a few things. It's our starting point here is that the investment environment that we're now facing looks an awful lot different because of the changes that Ira and I have articulated. Naturally, the investment climate changes. So you don't, I don't think you change, you change policy to the degree that we've changed it, and you change this globalization paradigm the way that it is changing, and then you just have the same investment environment. I think it stands to reason that you have a different one. And in that environment, we should see, number one, higher levels of inflation, but also with high inflation comes higher volatility, not just in markets, but also in actual inflation. So when you look historically at periods of rising inflation, you also see volatile inflation. So we expect to see higher ambient levels of inflation and also greater variability in that. That in itself tends to lead to a more dynamic trading environment. And it tends to harm highly leveraged strategies that are kind of set forget type strategies. So we think that when you look back over the last few decades, and certainly the last, let's call it, post 08, kind of leveraged carry strategies have just been wonderful, particularly ones where you've bet that bonds and stocks would have the correlation features whereby oftentimes they both went up, but at times when the equity market went down, bonds really went up. And so you could build a pretty robust portfolio rather easily because you're buying assets that both have positive expectancy through time, and you can leverage that portfolio and have a really successful outcome. And that's what most investors did. Conservative ones, I suppose, had a 60-40 portfolio. Really aggressive ones had a 90-10 portfolio, or they took a 60-40 and they leverage it in all sorts of ways. And there are a bunch of creative ways that Wall Street has found to help people leverage that. Private equity is obviously a great way to do it. You're just buying less liquid equities, you're leveraging them, and then you're kind of muting the marking of them. And that, so there are all sorts of things that investors have used in the past. We think that those will just work less well. And then the question is, well, what will work well? And so, I mentioned it's a more dynamic investing environment. So think that, leverage carry won't work the way it's worked in the past. It doesn't mean you can't make money doing it. It just means that if you do it, you're probably gonna have to endure some really painful drawdowns that, either your investors may redeem on you, or, if you're a big pension plan, your board may just say, we can't handle this level of drawdown. And so you get out the worst possible time. So things like that, I think, are important considerations. So it doesn't mean the strategy won't work at all. It just means that you're probably gonna have to size it way down, and or you're gonna have to deal with a lot more volatility. So those things will be kind of tricky. I think that passive investing will also be very difficult. We probably have seen peak passive, and so the dominance of firms like BlackRock are probably wane through this next decade. Then the question is, well, so what do you do? So trading strategy should work a lot better. I think we'll see a lot of money move into alternatives. We're seeing those flows right now, incidentally. And when we sit in front of our different investment clients and listen to their boards. I think they're all in the process of reconsidering their portfolio construction and their allocation mix. And so alternatives, I think, will be a growing share of those portfolios, but those changes take literally years, you know, quarter by quarter by quarter of different allocation changes and then reallocation and redemptions. And, you know, these, it'll take a long period of time. In terms of specific strategies that I think will work particularly well, I think systematic trend following will have a resurgence. So systematic trend following is something that we do as a firm, along with a range of other strategies. We have volatility strategies, we have dispersion strategies, we have hedging strategies, we have an inflation strategy, we do things in digital assets. You know, we have a broad range of strategies, which is kind of a reflection of, I think, how I think about investing. Very opportunistic. You know, I hunt for what I consider to be the most important risks and opportunities in the marketplace, and then we want to make sure that we have vehicles to express those so that we can help our clients navigate those risks. Or I shouldn't even say navigate those risks. When I look at a risk, I look at that as an opportunity. Although for our investors, they may view it as a risk. For me, if there's a risk in the world that I think is likely to manifest, then it means we can make a lot of money, you know, expressing that in a portfolio. So that's kind of the way we build strategies and think about investing. But I think oftentimes I try to think about, okay, in a decade in the future, when I look back, you know, what decisions will I be happy that I made? And what views would I be happy that I held? And of course, you never know with certainty, but it helps you kind of focus in on what your real conviction is. I think systematic trend following is a way to capitalize on trends across a broad array of markets. So we trade 120 markets, where we have a quantitative approach to just following the trends up and down across those markets. And why I like that is because ultimately what a trend reflects is it reflects a change in the future, a material change in the future relative to today that's just not priced in. And so if you think about what's happening in the world right now, I think we are on the cusp and we are beginning to experience very substantial change. Very substantial change is difficult for people to process mentally, just is in our personal lives and in our market life. And so when big changes happen, a price will move substantially over time. And when you have this world of greater policy heterogeneity because of politicians being involved, we don't even know what some of those big changes will be, because they're going to be driven by humans making decisions to maybe go to war or maybe not go to war or find peace or, you know, integrate their economies more or onshore more production, all of these things, you know, or hoard commodities or, you know, or redirect resources domestically to produce food, even though that, you know, that affects some other part of their economy. Like all these things are going to start unfolding over the next decade. They're unfolding right now. And to be able to capitalize on that change in a systematic, dispassionate way, whether it's up or down, seems to me a great just baseline strategy to have embedded in your portfolio. And the best way to capitalize on that is this systematic trend following.
And your thoughts are great.
No, I understand that, because again, so for many people who view this podcast, they're traders, and in a trading way, it's difficult to do this. And I know, because I've tried to do this my entire life. Accordingly, you know, according to Steve Drobny, who wrote Inside the House of Money, when he interviewed me, he said, I don't really believe you exist, because how can you take that type of outlook strategy and try to make money on a day-to-day basis? And that's, you know, for me, that's my bogey that I have to overcome. But my investable portfolio, which is where my retirement funds go to either live or die, can take that much longer view in the way that I operate on a day. That's a trader's, but there's always the underpinning of this, because I think Eric says it, you know, really well, because when you do see that change, you are going to get momentum to it. Right now, we are not living in that world yet. I think Anybody who, and I know Eric has a chief research, I forget his name.
Marcel Kazimovich, yeah.
Yeah, very, very good. But anybody who analyzes markets from a fundamental viewpoint is made crazy by the algorithms. Algorithms care not, in today's trading world, and they derive a lot of money, they care not a lick about fundamentals over any kind of period of time. So from a value standpoint, I'm always searching for when they run ragged over a market, and then we see opportunities. You know, it's just like when Lewis, we did a couple of podcasts, Eric, with Lewis Gavay and Mark Faber, you know, some I'm sure, you know, very, and they've been great. But, and we caught them at the time when the markets had run roughshod over everything and just driven everything by price. Everything mm-hmm. collapsed because everybody finally threw up their hands and go, you know, I've got this. So, you know, you're able to buy Freeport at $8. Those were real time trades. So those we look for. We'll always look for them. Go ahead. You want to, if you think the theme is wrong, go run roughshod. I don't care. I'm never committed enough at any one time not to be able to avail myself of that opportunity. I mean, it's really the greatness of Buffett. And Buffett just showed it to you because he has $110 billion sitting on the sideline. So when other people are throwing everything out, everything, because they have to go and liquidate to raise funds to meet any type of redemptions, he's scouring the investable landscape to see what is there to garner. And that's true value investing, you know, not on a day-to-day, but you see, and I applaud them. So I'm going to ask the question. So over the last, with the breakdown of the 60-40, I don't like lazy investing. So I'm never a passive investor because I always think, it's not an ego thing. I put a lot of effort into work. So I don't just hear the only ETF I ever bought, I can't do anything with now. And that's the Russian, that's the Russian fund. I'm just kind of stuck. It was really a good investment for a number of years. Now I just have to wait to see how that's going to fall out, but I'm always looking for things. So over the last 12 months, how have you guys been doing? I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Trying to, you know, that this does work better than a lot of other investable ideas.
Yeah, over the last year, I mean, really over the last few years, we've, touch wood, done very well with our investors, for our investors. I think I mentioned earlier that we had anticipated this policy paradigm shift, so that led us to be pretty well positioned going into COVID. Obviously, we had no idea that we would have a catalyst for this shift as powerful as COVID was, because I think it was about the most powerful catalyst for this policy transition that I could have fathomed, other than a world war. And that would, you know, that would have led us in all sorts of different directions. But, it kind of is like just a global catastrophe that united the left and right across pretty much every country to just embark on very large deficit spending to the extent that they could. Even some countries, they couldn't afford to do it. They did it, and they kind of got away with it in a way. The markets let them get away with it. So it's really, you know, that... We were well positioned through that. So, you know, 2020, we had a very good year. And some of the things we did in long volatility worked out extremely well that year. And we're able to get out of the way, both in our discretionary programs and our algorithmic, our quantitative programs got out, kind of did very well through that period. Last year was a good year. Trend following did well as well last year, and this year has been just a kind of a fabulous year in trend following. Some of the vol trading that we've done has been kind of fine. Some of the hedging stuff that we've done, it's either been pretty decent, but in equity vol hasn't really exploded higher, so long equity volatility programs just have had muted performance this year, kind of like they did in Q4 of 2018, where you had a pretty decent decline in equity markets, but the VIX didn't explode higher, for instance. So that's been a little bit disappointing, but that happens in vol markets in the sense that sometimes you have controlled equity market declines without a coincident big explosion in implied volatilities. Interestingly, in 2008, it kind of looked a bit like this year, in that you had a bear market in equities and implied vol really didn't go crazy until Lehman happened. And so it was kind of like you had a bear market without a vol explosion, and you had a vol explosion that was late, you know, kind of late in the bear market. And that was a very powerful one. So kind of when we look at some of the models that we trade, they would have actually, if you map them onto that period, they would have lost a bit of money and then just post Lehman, just through the end of the year, they would have been up 80% kind of thing. So it's really, you know, you get different types of vol regimes depending on the nature of a bear market. I don't know if we'll have a big fracture in this market. I think we will over the next few years. I think there'll be a big market fracture and a very large vol event. It'll probably happen at a point where people are complacent because they just look at vol and they go, oh, it hasn't really moved, so I guess I shouldn't be long a lot of it. And some people will be shorted, and then there'll be a market fracture for some reason, and then it'll go bananas. Our inflation strategy's done well. This month has been a very tough month for trend, because we've had this kind of big jump in equities, a decline in the dollar. But our core trend strategy is probably still up, you know, 25, 27% on the year, that type of thing. So been a good year, you know, in some of the things we're doing in digital assets. We had a blowout success in we made at the time as the largest institutional allocation to Bitcoin and Ethereum in November 2020. We were out of that position by kind of Q3 of 2021. We made well over $1 billion on that, or I should say our clients did. That's a very unique client, a UK client, which one of the smartest CIOs that an insightful CIO is, a true iconoclast type investor. And that was really fun to work on. But we've had some exposure to crypto on the way down, but it's been very, very small relative to relative to our early position. And I think there's some amazing opportunities that are going to unfold here in digital assets, which is, you know, maybe a bit of a controversial view given all the, you know, some of the recent fraud activity with this guy SBF and his company FTX, which is extraordinary. But from my perspective, it's a crisis like so many other crises that I've seen. It's a pretty spectacular one. There'll be great books written about it, movies and all those things. But from a market perspective, I feel like I've seen this before, different version of this before. And there usually are great opportunities on the backside that you just got to make sure that you don't get touched by it. We so far have not been.
And for the crypto blockchain markets, what's your view for the future in terms of opportunities there? And also, do you think that governments will allow private-based cryptos to coexist along government cryptos, you know, central bank digital currencies?
Yeah, I think that they will, Richard. But it's obviously, you know, it's healthy to ask questions like that, you know, when you look at these markets. I think that there's very, very little chance that the governments try to outlaw these private technologies. I think it'd be self-defeating, it'd be silly, you know, whichever jurisdiction tried to do it, all it would do would be push innovation to another jurisdiction. I think that, well, maybe here's the framework I would use. to those who are skeptical of these technologies. I'm obviously not skeptical because I've built out a digital arm of our business. And it's been great for our clients that we have done that. And it's been a really interesting journey through that as well. I see a world in, let's call it 10 to 20 years, where all assets become tokenized, meaning stocks, bonds, real estate, art, literally every, you know, commodities, everything will be traded in a tokenized form, meaning the form that Bitcoin or ETH is currently traded in. Those are tokens. So I think all assets will become tokenized. And that will mean that they can trade on a standard set of trading and settlement rails, and custodied in a consistent way in digital wallets. I think every major institution will have multiple digital wallets and digital custodians, just like they do with, you know, for their equities and bonds. They'll have their State Streets and their Bonies. In this case, they'll have Coinbase, and they'll have, you know, a variety of other custodians. And trading will happen more or less instantaneously. Settlement will happen more or less instantaneously. It'll be more secure. There'll be greater transparency. Regulators will love these things, will love this transition, because all the reports that they get and their transparency into counterparties' balance sheets and everything will be real time, and there'll be evidence. So it will promote financial stability. And I know that sounds controversial in a world where there's not a lot of financial stability in digital asset markets right now, but that's where the technology will lead us, right? So that's what we think that world looks like. I think that there'll be a ton of innovation as the world transitions to blockchain rails and this financial infrastructure for the global financial markets that's built on blockchain. There'll be all sorts of innovation that's built on top of that. Some of it will be central bank digital currency, and maybe in private networks. Some of them will be in public networks, to specifically answer your question. I think in a world where everyone has a digital wallet, some of these assets will probably become extremely valuable, because number one, there is value in them. In some of these assets or some of these blockchains provide security for settlement, smart contract platforms. Like there are a variety of uses that these things provide, and so I believe that there will be value assigned to them. And in a world where everyone can buy them, because everyone, both individuals and corporations and investment funds, have digital wallets, I think the universe of people who can buy them will expand dramatically. So I think their value will go up quite a ways. But I think that the last thing I'll just say is, I often get from people, there's just, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors, there's no value to it. Here's my simple response to that. If you look at what the Chinese have done, the Chinese looked at these technologies and they said, wow, they are so powerful that we want to build a central bank digital digital currency. And why they want to do that? They want to do it because what that means is, it means that they have programmable money. And programmable money gives a government enormous power, because the Chinese government, if you have money in yuan, they could turn it off, they could give you some, they could force you to use it in only particular ways, they could limit the ability of you to use it, then they could turn it back on. Like, there are all sorts of things that they can do. They can track all of your transactions. So for people who just don't right now see, you know, where this could lead, I don't see all the places it can lead. All I know is that if a government out there, if one of the largest governments in the world, I guess the largest government in the world, wants to adopt this as the foundation for their monetary system because of its power, then for me, that's all I need to know, that these are very powerful technologies. They can be used in all sorts of ways. The Chinese are going to use it in the way they're going to use it. And I sincerely hope that the West doesn't use it in that way. But these are very powerful technologies. And so when I see a really powerful technology that's fundamental, as money, I want to make sure that we are really on top of that so that we can capitalize on the opportunities that will be represented by this transition to this new technology platform. So that's kind of the most simple way that I look at it.
Interesting. Great perspective. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I always break this discussion up into blockchain versus digital coin. I have to my chagrin, I must add, because as long as I've been looking at it, but I was able to advise and take a nice investment in a firm called Ninth Gear, which is oriented towards blockchain under Marianne Morrow. And I would advise everybody taking a look at Ninth Gear. I think it's won several quote unquote contests in the technological world, especially of banking. And I think everything that Eric says is right. We're going to go there. It scares the hell out of me because of everything he talks about the Chinese. Now, you know, I've read Leo Brainard last year or 2 years ago was leading the Fed's work on the central bank digital coin concept. Now, I've argued with people for even long before it became popular that electronic money and a debit card is electronic money, by the way. If the Fed could push everybody into a debit card, they have the ability to control your spending. And that has always frightened me because we saw the Fed, as they would say, hit the zero bound, right? They knew the ECB, because they had a different situation, they could go to negative rates. The Fed never went to negative rates. The market may have gone to negative rates as people were pursuing high quality liquid collateral, but the Fed itself never went to negative rates. It was fearful of it because what would happen? Well, and he said, you know, negative rates are very deflationary because people are going to take their money out of the banking system. What kind of moron do you have to be to sit there and go, please only take 50 basis points from my account. It's bad enough when you're getting zero. You know, this has been, again, as I always laugh at the tellers, I bank at JP Morgan Chase. And when I go to cash a check, yes, I carry cash in my pocket for this reason, by the way, not because I'm an iconoclast. I can't help my, you know, I always have to look at things a little bit differently. And as my friend Chuck and I always talk about, if it's not in my pocket, it's not real anyway. The only custodial and I trust is my right hand pocket. Outside of that, everything is vulnerable. When I go to the bank, I put my hands up as I give them my check. You know, and it's a standard joke but it's changing. But the fact that they would have control over your money, why do I say that? Because if it was all electronic, the Fed knows this. I mean, go look at Rogoff, go look at Summers. There's been a lot of academic research on this. They could take, in order to generate the animal spirits and spending in the economy, they could take rates negative 5%. And if it's electronic money, there's really not much you can do about it. There's no more taking your money and stuffing it in your mattress. They have control over this. And they would love to get there. Now they do it under the, well, we got to get rid of cash because it's only drug dealers and Ira Harris who use cash. So what? Who are we really punishing? But it really harms the lower end of the economy at this point in time, because the lower end of the economy is severely underbanked and will remain underbanked. You saw it. I'll tell you what, I stopped going to baseball games when I couldn't spend cash anymore. I really thought Major League Baseball had a problem because who were they punishing? And so I had this discussion with my son-in-law, big Met fan. They live in Long Island City. And I said, well, I'm not going to game. He says, why? I said, because they won't take cash. He says, well, you can go there and I know Citibank will sell you a card, a debit card for the day, but I have to pay a fee to get it. So I said, Eric, that's his name, Eric. I said, that's not right. You're punishing those at the lower end of the economic who maybe not carry a credit card because you have to pass your card. I said, they're making a grave mistake. You're driving them out. The cash society is not as nefarious. Yeah, does it avoid taxation? Yes, but I would argue that there's one hedge fund person who is able to avoid far more taxation on one tax return than these people will do collectively. So, you know, I'm not buying. I'm speaking for the smaller non-bank. So I know this is where this is going. And as Eric so pointed, you know, so we're going to find investable opportunities and how, but it also affects monetary policy. And as Eric talks about, as we talk about the global nature of it, so we look at what the Fed has done and we look at the global impact of it. So does the Fed have a triple mandate? It's always the question that boggles my mind. I know that they're worried about jobs. I know that they're worried about inflation, but do they owe the global system because of the dollar's role as a reserve currency in all of this a greater, that sometimes it may step force them to step back on the dual mandate and supply the triple mandate, as they did, by the way, in March and April of 2020. So, I mean, all of this ties in. This is not by mistake, but I think Eric hit it right, blew it out of the ballpark, because it becomes a custodial issue. And what really fascinates me about Eric is they said, well, we got out in the third quarter of 2021.
Yeah.
Am I? Yeah. So, see, I respect that because you're always moving. You know, nothing is forever. Nothing. No matter what you think, it's nothing forever. And when it comes to the investable world, wow, here's a great opportunity. Da, 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 and now we're out. And now we can take a look. And I think he's right. Through, as we sift through the sands of whatever is going to fall out from here, there's going to be mega opportunity. I don't know what it is yet, but in people's rush because they won't have a good thing to say about any of this for months and months and months and months. It'll be toxic to everybody. And then you'll find opportunity.
Yeah, just to be clear, we got out of all of our early investments. We're not completely out of this market. Okay. I've remained invested personally in these markets through this period. And we think that there's, you know, like I think these, when I really look at these assets, they're trading opportunities and they're investment opportunities. I think the investment opportunities, my view is when I think about investments, I try to think in terms of what I want to be holding this in 10 years. And I think that these prices would be a lot higher on the things that we hold in 10 years. But on the central bank digital currency, I'd like to paint a different potential path as well here in the US, which I and we and our advisory board, which is led by Jake Clayton, the former SEC chairman, we and our board have collectively advocated for a move toward private stablecoin, private US dollar stablecoin. So the technology that we discussed in the way the Chinese have applied it is to create a tokenized yuan, digital currency, that is controlled by the central bank. So that's a central bank digital currency. We do not have a central bank digital currency denominated in dollars right now. We do have what are called private sector stable coins, which are tokenized dollars. And some of those, and there have been a number of approaches to create a private sector dollar denominated stable coin. Some of those have been based offshore, and what's backing them is various forms of collateral. It could be commercial paper, it could be T-bills. They're not really, they haven't been regulated by the U.S., so it's not even necessarily clear exactly what backs them. Some of them have been backed by other digital tokens in an algorithmic way to try to maintain their stability. And some of those have worked out okay, and some of them have been disasters. And then there's a kind of a domestically built one called USDC, which is a private sector stable coin that is, you imagine it just being backed by T-bills. Okay. So there are a variety of different ways that the private sector has been able to create digital dollars. And what's really interesting about that to me, as someone focused on money and what money means and how it works and how it's built and why we have faith in it or lose faith in it. What's really interesting to me is that in a free market, so that these digital asset markets they're as free as any market that we've seen in our lifetime, which is why they are so volatile. There is no lender of last resort. There's There's very little government intervention, in some cases government oversight, so really free market. Well, that free market has overwhelmingly chosen the stablecoin balances to be denominated in US dollars, not yuan, not yen, not sterling, not euros, not dollars or anything else, the US dollars. So it's probably 95% of all the stablecoin in the marketplace is denominated in US dollars, not because the US is the dominant, US investors are the dominant investors. For much of the time, the Chinese were actually dominant investors and they wanted digital dollars, okay? So we have private sector dollar stablecoin. And I think that what we have advocated for is for the US to kind of bring that into the regulatory purview of the Fed and the US banking system just generally, so that the government in the US can get comfortable with that, but not control it like the Chinese control their currency. And in that world, in a world where private sector stablecoin is allowed to flourish, I think what will happen over the coming decade will be that as the world transitions to tokenized infrastructure and digital wallets, and every corporation, again, every investor, every individual have a digital wallet, I could see a world where people could choose to use the US dollar, or they could use their, I don't know, their Euro central bank digital currency, or their Chinese central bank digital currency. And in that world, I think that you could see this massive adoption, even bigger than the current adoption of the US dollar globally. You could see this massive adoption of digital dollars where people go, look, it's a private sector dollar. It's regulated by the US. It is arm's length from the US, which means that, yes, they could get information about what I'm doing under subpoena, but there's at least rule of law, as opposed to in China, if I own digital yuan, they just turn it off and I can't go to the courts and deal with that. So I think that I know that there are many voices within the US government that would prefer that private structure. It's kind of more in keeping with just American free market philosophy. So there's no doubt that there are going to be people in government that would like the control of a central bank digital currency, but I can assure you that that is not the dominant voice out there. I think there's highly likely that we just adopt this private sector, you know, private market stablecoin that is part of the regulatory structure of the US, and then it becomes extremely popular. I could even see countries that don't have really well run central banks and overall systems, I could see them adopting the digital dollar in ways that US paper currency just could never scale, because digital can scale. So it's a pretty exciting world. I mean, that's, again, I obviously think there are lots of opportunities in digital, in this digital build out, but that's one of them. I think it could be incredibly bullish for the dollar over the long term.
But if I may ask, so as I listen to this, and I've read your stuff over the years, so, but I sit back and I go, doesn't this actually generate, and I said it because Leo Brainer's written about this, so I mean, this thought process is out there. This is not to me, if I was running this, I would gravitate to back them by some modicum amount of precious metals, because I'll hold it, or you can hold it all you want, but if my coin is 20% backed by a combination of gold, silver, platinum, let's say, it would give me some sense of stability where most fiat currencies don't, because we're still reliant on the fiat currency world, even under the digital dollar.
Yeah, so, Ira, I think that ship has sailed, man. I think that the Chinese might attempt something like that.
That's
the Chinese might. So the Chinese might. There is a school of thought, and I'm open to it. This isn't my base case, but I'm very open to it, where the Chinese actually say, listen, we want to unseat the dollar. So we're going to first scale the digital yuan domestically, and then we're going to push our trading partners to use it. And then we want the world to use it. And, you know, that they don't think Americans are going to use it, but they probably think all of Africa, the Middle East and Asia will use it. And we're going to back it by, gold and silver, whatever it may be. There's some thought that they could partially back it by that. Now, could you ever get it? Absolutely not. Like it, who? So it would be, in my opinion, it would be a mirage. You would just go, okay, so great. So now I have a digital yuan. I actually want to get, and it's 20% backed by gold. I actually want to go and get that gold. You'll never be able to get it, in my opinion. But it could be kind of a clever pitch in a way. I think that what we've learned, and I started, my career as libertarian, kind of hard money type person. I just don't think it works in a modern world. So I think the people, in a big dynamic economy with the political structure that we have, the level of inequality that we have, and the need for government to kind of continually try to rebalance the economic pie from, workers and owners of capital. I think that that's kind of what a successful government tries to do. Not saying the governments are doing a great job of that, but I think that that's part of what a government does, is just say, look, let's try to foster an environment to have as big an economic pie as we can, and then let's figure out how to divide it up. And again, there are all kinds of corrupt actors and good actors and bad actors in that process. But I think that that's what they do. And having a fiat currency gives the government a greater ability to do that. Having a hard currency limits their ability. And so I think in the absence of a complete financial meltdown in the US and the West that requires a reset and a total loss of faith in the fiat system, in the absence of that, I think we'll continue to have a fiat system. And for those of, for the people who want to have something backed by gold, then they just use their digital dollars and just go and buy gold. You don't have to have your currency backed by gold. You can just own gold. And so, like, imagine that you live in Argentina and inflation is whatever. Let's say it's 80%, right? And your choice is to keep your money in Argentine pesos, or to move it to gold, or move it to real estate, or move it to digital dollars. So let's say over the long haul, inflation in dollars is, and therefore monetary debasement, isn't 2% like we've targeted. Maybe it ends up being 3 or 4%. Maybe there are times that right now, like it's 8%. It's still a hell of a lot better. That having money in digital dollars is still, for anyone in Argentina, is a hell of a lot better than keeping it in pesos, right? And so if you have a system that allows you to move your money around really easily, and you're not hoarding actual paper dollar bills that you bought in the black market and stuff like that, I just think the dollar will be a much better store of value, even if it's temporary for those people. If they really are worried about it over the long haul, they can, go out and buy gold or something, or real estate. But I just think that that's where the world is going with the digital dollar.
Wow, great insight. And I like that approach. The last question on the US dollar, given the trade-off benefits of, rising interest rates as the central bank, a Federal Reserve, is using to tackle inflation, but, versus the negatives of higher servicing costs on the national debt, what do you make of the US dollar and also the potential negative effects on emerging markets if it strengthens too much? Has it peaked? Will it be controlled or coordinated central bank intervention? In recent couple of months, right, it's been coming down. But what are your thoughts on the U.S. dollar, Eric?
I'd love to hear Ira's thoughts. You focus on this an awful lot. I certainly have my own, but
my view has been that the dollar is going too high, too fast. Only because, and I know, and I get tired of it. I think the old model was, well, stronger currency, it'll beat back inflation. But I think that's a 70s point of view. And the structural change has been the huge role the dollar plays in funding debt. The dollar became a currency, a carry currency. Now, I can't remember when the dollar was a carry currency, except the recipient of higher interest rates, of course. But it was used on the other side of the ledger as the Fed stayed at zero for far too long and kept pushing money into the system. So the world is borrowed up in dollars. Well, a world borrowed up in dollars is a world filled with dollar liabilities. And I think that's a phenomenal drag on the entire global economy. And that, yes, I understand the Fed dual mandate, but your policies have created this to be untenable situation because the dollar, listen, we up until a week and a half ago, the dollar was up 21% for the year, 19% with rising rates. So you have the worst situation, especially for those who are on hedge. And to me, that's a very important element in here that a lot of people are, because, you know, again, it's a Minsky moment, which I love, because people get very complacent. Hey, interest rates haven't moved. What do I need to hedge for? That's a silly thing. I'm just, pissing away money every quarter as I do my, so you stop doing that. Now all of a sudden the dollar starts to move and people realize how many dollar liabilities they have, and to fund those liabilities becomes ever more expensive. And I think that now, as the US would say, that's the Treasury's department, it's not the Fed's. The Fed has their, everybody hides behind their mandates. I find that nice convenience. They're good when you want them to be. They're, you know, we can play with them all we want, but you do have a global responsibility, especially when you're asking a lot of the globe. You want them to come along on the decarbonization of the world. You want them to grow with you on the green, you know, and I'm not discussing those. I think those are all noble and good things, but when you're bearing a burden on them, it's tough to ask more and more. They want you to, you know, they bash the Indians and the Chinese for buying Russian oil through the Ukrainian situation. But what would you do if the United States was in dire need of oil to heat? Listen, we already see the political fallout coming in where you live, because those heating bills, I couldn't believe how stupid the Republicans were, because the only ads they should have been running to me was Putin, Biden saying we're all going to bear a burden. And then somebody opening up their monthly utility bill going, you know, and that would have been, you don't have to say anymore, because it's now coming home, especially in the heating oil world where I don't know whether you heat by heating oil. I'm going to bet by where you live, propane or heating oil. So
yeah, it's heating oil. Yeah.
Yep. So these are, we're bearing a lot of burdens. So, and yet we're running the dollar up and somebody, oh, this is a great thing. This is a great, I'm not of that ilk. The dollar is because of its role as a funding vehicle, you have to be very careful here. And I think that Yellen must have gotten an earful at the G20 yet again, because Sunday night from Bali, she was talking about, well, there are considerations about the financial situation facing the world. And then today the dollar, of course, is up, as you know, we had Bullard talking about the need. Oh, now all of a sudden they've all find their way. Those who are hawkish are now quoting the Taylor rule, which they never had, you know, because everybody forgets that for the 18 months ago, if you would have cited the Taylor rule, they would have cited the need to create jobs for everybody who lost their jobs, you know. And we don't have room for a Taylor rule, but now they're all falling back. I find it, you know, again, it's the policy of convenience. I think the dollar is a real issue here in a global macro way. And we see it with the interest rates, but that's the way that I would proceed. Now, we didn't even really talk interest rates at all, what's going on with yield curves. And I don't know whether that's part of your analysis that you guys put in there. It's a big part of my analysis. I find the 2-10s curve actually kind of preposterous, but it's driving the dollar higher. I'm kind of surprised that the dollar stayed on its heels. The Fed meeting was November 2nd. By November 4th, the dollar was already closing below the previous. So, I mean, the dollar has been weak up until this point. I'll be interesting to see how it closes today, but it's recovering some of its quote unquote mojo, but it's not necessarily good for the world.
Hmm. Yeah, this is, you know, the way we're viewing the cycle is just really different from typical cycles. You know, typical cycle, you would have had a very weak dollar coming into recession, you know, because the just a lot of Americans shipping dollars abroad, basically, a lot of global activity. And this time around, it's interesting because we're going to have a really strong dollar coming into recession. Usually the strong dollar happens, the strongest dollar happens, you know, in recession, where everyone is just scrambling to kind of cover their dollar loans. So that, you know, their dollar shorts, international players, and people are repatriating money back to the US. And this cycle is just different. You know, we probably will have a recession, and the dollar will be really strong going into the recession. And then the Fed is going to pivot. And I think the recent weakness in the dollar, and it really is just recent, is, I think, just sniffing out the potential for the end of the cycle. I agree with you that strong dollars is incredibly painful for the world. And we've looked at commodity prices priced in dollars. I mean, imagine if you have a really weak currency, what those commodities, you know, energy and food, what does that look like in your depreciated dollar if you're in the UK or you're in Turkey or you're, you know, wherever. So this is just, you know, it's painful for the world. Currencies don't move in a straight line. I remain optimistic about the US in spite of a lot of our domestic political woes, fractures, and these various things. I just think that, you know, relative to other regions in the world, this is a better place in terms of treating capital, with fewer, you know, kind of just fewer problems, even though we have many, and they're material ones too. Just think we're a bit better off. So at least for the time being, I remain overall positive on the dollar. I don't think this rate hike cycle is over. I don't think the dollar collapses in advance of the rate hike cycle being over, but it's awfully high already. You know, it's a little late to get super bullish on the dollar. It doesn't mean you couldn't have a blow off top in the dollar. I remember a couple of years ago, everyone was so bearish on the dollar, and that, you know, that just didn't seem quite right. When Putin invaded Ukraine, I remember, like, dollar yen didn't go lower. It went lower a little bit, you know, on the kind of a quick flight to quality, and then it kind of started going higher. And those are really important. As you know, there are a lot of people who are positioned that way, who are positioned short dollars versus the yen if they were worried about something bad happening in the world. And when trades like that don't work out, doesn't mean it always races away in the other direction, but it often does. And so that was kind of a tell. That was an important tell in terms of where the dollar is going. I haven't yet seen the tell in the other direction. So my bias is dollar probably still, you know, heads higher over time here. But I agree with you that it creates increasing levels of pain internationally. And at some point that has real blowback to the US, and policy will respond. Now, I think looking out over the next decade, I think that in spite of the fact that the Fed is hiking rates and trying to contain inflation, because inflation has moved faster than they would have wanted, big picture, I think the US government has made the decision to partially inflate away the substantial debts that we have already incurred and the liabilities that we have already signed up to, and the additional debts that we are likely to incur over the next decade. And so the only way to really do that is to keep interest rates below the level of inflation over the medium to long term. So I expect that will happen. So this period of tight policy, I don't know when it will give way, you know, sometime certainly over the next year. And then I expect, you know, overnight rates to remain probably well below the holistic rates of inflation over the next 10 to 15 years. And that doesn't tend to be a bullish dollar environment, by the way. There'll be periods of ups and downs, but that construct that I just described is one where we're actively trying to debase the currency. And I think the government has the ability to do that. And I think it will do that. So, anyhow, that's kind of how we're thinking about it.
I can't agree more. And again, because again, people look at the long end. I'm not looking at the long end of money. If you want to fight inflation, you fight it on the short end. That's mm-hmm. that's the way you fight. That's the Volcker proven rule. I can, and that's really comes out of Schumpeter and classic economists that, hey, I can take short-term rates high enough to choke you off from borrowing money. If I choke you off from borrowing money, the economy is going to slow down. I mean, the whole concept of pushing on a string is that I can't lower rates, as we learned, low enough to get you to borrow if there's no economic activity, but I can take rates high enough quickly to choke you off to say, well, I can't borrow money because I can't make a real return. So, you know, and my pushback again, we did a really nice podcast a couple of weeks ago, November 3rd to be, with Buchvar and who I have a lot of respect for, like Peter, and David Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't get overly bearish equities as long as real yields stay negative on the short end. Mm-hmm. And Powell mm-hmm. wants to get again to a real positive Fed funds yield. Will he be able to do it? I don't think so, because of the huge amount of debt that has to be funded. It saddles you. You break the system so badly. So I love your point. I think that's right. And you know what? It's what Rogoff, you know, I kind of laugh at anybody who read This Time Is Different, Rogoff's book. The whole viewpoint was to create 4-6% inflation for a number of years to be able to basically debase the debt, because mm-hmm. there's nothing that gets rid of the debt overhang, as you aptly point out. So I love that we're finishing here. Then the ability to erode it away, whether you're clipping silver coin, whatever it is, historically, that's where we're at. So it's a beautiful place to end. And as usual, this is great. And I have great respect for you guys. And people don't even know that when Eric talks about these things, he's him and his wife, who I've never had the pleasure of meeting, and they've produced such great kids. And I know, because at the beginning of COVID, when your son and daughter put out that call to help kids in their, I mean, I was blown away. You know, I told
you me, were very, that's very kind of you. You were very generous to support their, that charity.
When you see kids
very touching, Ira.
Step up like that and do things like that. It's not by accident, by the way. And the fact that they've both wound up where they're at, which is, you know, in the service of their country, it's a great testament to what you and your wife. So
thank you. That is
and very the youngest one will wait for. I'm a fourth boy in line. So, you know, he's got that fight to him. I can see every time you write about, you know, he's,
he does.
Brings a chuckle to my, because I'm a nasty, I fight fair, but. You know what? I was beat on by three older brothers, and I know what it takes. And so, it always brings a chuckle to me. But it's a great place to end.
Yeah, very kind. Thank you. Well, I really appreciate and respect your writing and your work. And
thank you.
Thanks for having me. And thank you, Richard. Yeah, it's been great.
Yes. Thank you so much.
And people should contact you, because your investment success is undeniable, and you're flexible, and that's what people should really look at, because to have great flexibility in this world is pretty good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Great. All right, gentlemen.
All right. Thanks. Be well.
All right. Wonderful. All right. Thanks a lot. Great. Okay. Great to chat.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.